Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1142, Deep Politics and the Death of Park Wonsoon, Part 3. This is being recorded on July 24th of 2020. Now, as indicated, obviously, by the title, this program will further develop some of the deep politics underlying the alleged suicide of Park Wonsoon. I am very suspicious of his death. The recounting of the circumstances is beyond the time scope of this program. Suffice it to say that he not only was a populist champion, and that's populist in the best sense of the term in South Korea, critical of the influence of big business and income inequality on Korean society and South Korean politics. He also had done much to unseat a former conservative prime minister and to obtain the conviction on corruption charges of the former head of the giant Samsung electronics company. Beyond that, he was critical of Japan's colonial occupation of Korea. He was critical of the comfort women, the slave prostitutes who were used by the Japanese for their army, and has been the focal point of controversy and altogether equivocal assumption of responsibility by the Japanese. Beyond that, Park Wonsoon was an advocate of North Korean reconciliation between North and South Korea, something that had earned him the derogatory term of, quote, commie, unquote, at the hands of conservatives. Beyond that, he had filed suit against the Shincheonji fascist mind control cult, which certainly was a vector for bringing the COVID-19 virus into South Korea, and I suspect it may have been one of the multiple vectors, or one of the vectors getting the virus into Wuhan itself. It had a branch church in Wuhan. As we have seen, the Shincheonji cult had both doctrinal and operational overlap with the Unification Church of Sun Myung-moon, which, although nominally Korean, appears to have been an extension of the Japanese patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies, or secret societies, around the world and through the years. Once again, we're going to touch on the role of the Japanese patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies, or secret societies, as we take a look at some of the history not only of World War II, of the Japanese occupation of Korea, but the genesis of the Korean War itself. We will be taking a look at the role of the Korean War in global economics, in helping to secure the sanctity of the Golden Lily Loosh, the looted wealth of Asia, which comprised, as revealed in the book Gold Warriors, a major element of the post-World War II global economy. We will be taking a look at John Foster Dulles and his role not only in securing a very slanted peace treaty in 1951 on behalf of Japan. This after the Korean War had begun. We will also take a look at John Foster Dulles' role, helping to set up not only the IG Farben cartel, but as a champion at Sullivan and Cromwell, along with his brother Alan Dulles, of the international cartel system, and his advocacy on behalf of the fascist powers of World War II. And we will conclude with a look at the role of the Korean War in helping to jumpstart the post-World War II economies of both Germany and Japan. The deep politics surrounding Park Wonsoon's life and death, and the focal points of this program really involve the interrelationship of a number of different Asian nations and dynamics. The history of Japan's colonization of Korea, the role of China, a nationalist China, both as a an ally of Japan, and which really, although part of the allies, the allied powers of World War II, really a nationalist China under Chiang Kai-shek was playing both sides of the street, or working both sides of the street. It was a narco-fascist government that dealt extensively with the Japanese. In turn, Japanese and Korean and Chinese history, and the role of the Korean War and the genesis of the Korean War had a profound effect on the development of cartels, as we have seen. Well, as a point of entry into our discussion, we are going to begin with a New York Times obituary with which we concluded, for the record, 1141. This is the obituary of South Korean General Paik Sun-yup. And by the way, I am probably butchering many of the pronunciations in this program. Paik Sun-yup is capital P-A-I-K, last name capital S-U-N hyphen Y-U-P. He passed away at the age of 99. He was South Korea's first four-star general, lionized as a Korean War hero. But as we will see, or as we will review, he also had served in the Japanese Imperial Army during World War II in a unit that was active hunting Korean partisans who were fighting against Japan on behalf of Korean independence. The career, the enigmatic career of Paik Sun-yup, is a continuing focal point of controversy in Korea, and indeed, the late Park Won-soon was a critic of Japan's colonial occupation of Korea and an advocate of reconciliation. He filed suit against the fascist Shin Chong-ji cult. All of these things not only place... Oh, by the way, we should mention that Park Won-soon was a probable candidate for the 2022 presidential election in South Korea. One of many things that would have made him a priority target. The career of the late Paik Sun-yup in many ways embodies the dynamics that will feature in this program. From the New York Times of July 15th of 2020, this is by Cho Sang-hun, the sole bureau chief of the New York Times. Paik Sun-yup, South Korean general, seen as hero or traitor, dies at 99. It reads in part, Paik Sun-yup, South Korea's first four-star general who was lionized as a Korean War hero by the South Korean and U.S. militaries, but dismissed by many in his country as a traitor, died here on Friday. He was 99. Though widely credited for leading his troops in a pivotal battle of the Korean War, Mr. Paik was a divisive figure in his home country. In 2009, a South Korean presidential committee put him on a list of, quote, pro-Japanese and anti-nation, unquote, figures who had collaborated with Japanese colonizers during their rule of the Korean Peninsula. And again, that occupation, a major focal point of criticism by the late Park Won-soon. In 1941, Paik joined the Army of Manchukuo, a puppet state that Imperial Japan had established in Manchuria, and served in a unit known for hunting down Korean guerrillas fighting for independence, though Mr. Paik said he never engaged in actual battles with them. He was a first lieutenant when Japan was defeated in World War II and Korea was liberated. After the country was divided into the pro-American South and the Communist North, Mr. Paik was among the Koreans in Japan's colonial military who were recruited when the U.S. was helping to build a military for the South. If Paik Sun-yup is called a hero, what does that make Korean independence fighters who lost their lives at the hands of his old Manchuria unit? Asked Kim Won-woong, the head of Heritage of Korean Independence, a group recognized by the government for its members' struggle for independence. Quote, if he really wanted to be treated like a Korean War hero, he should at least have expressed repentance and remorse for his pro-Japanese deed, Mr. Kim added in an interview published last year, but he never has. Well, again, that enigmatic career, or perhaps schizoid career of Paik Yeon-sun, fighting on behalf of South Korea in the Korean War, fighting on behalf of Imperial Japan in a unit that was working against pro-independence Korean guerrillas, in many ways embodies the dynamics that we will be looking at in this program. We're going to turn next to something that not only highlights the role of nationalist Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek and his regime in the dynamics we're talking about, but in the things that we are talking about, we are looking at the genesis of the Asian People's Anti-Communist League. That was a mixed nationalist Chinese, Japanese, and South Korean, and also South Vietnamese anti-communist consortium that was part of the World Anti-Communist League, the European branch of which was the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, about which we have said much in the past. We'll come back to that dynamic again in our next pair of programs. What we're going to look at is the role of the nationalist Kuomintang regime in the formation, or actually in the grand alliance of Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin. Roosevelt himself died before the end of World War II. There is a hint in the book that we are going to be looking at that he may very well have been assassinated. I suspect that is the case. The book we're going to be looking at is JFK, the CIA, Vietnam, and the Plot to Assassinate John F. Kennedy by Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, former Air Force focal point officer and a first-hand participant in many of these events. What we're going to be looking at is the role of not only Chiang Kai-shek, but his wife, Madam Chiang Kai-shek, née Mae Ling Sung, the sister of T.V. Sung, who was the wealthiest man in the world at that time and was Chiang Kai-shek's finance minister at the same time. Although it has received very little publicity, they were not only participants in the Cairo Conference of November of 1943, but they then were flown by Colonel Prouty to the Tehran Conference. And as we will see, they apparently, force Chiang Kai-shek, so to speak, not only Chiang Kai-shek, but his wife, the sister of T.V. Sung, the wealthiest man in the world at that time, and the finance minister for Chiang Kai-shek, they appear to have exerted a profound influence on the course of the post-World War II planning that, as we will see, anticipated not only conflict in Indochina, well, part of which became Vietnam during the Vietnam War, but also Korea as well. Turning now to Colonel Prouty's book, JFK, the CIA, Vietnam, and the Plot to Assassinate John F. Kennedy, published by Skyhorse Publishing in hardcover in 2011. Although the alliance between the West and the Soviet Union during World War II had been welded in the heat of battle, it had never been on too firm a footing. This was especially true of its structure in the Far East. The Chinese leader, Chiang Kai-shek, was as much a dictator as either Hitler or Mussolini. And by the way, General Joseph Stilwell, who was the American advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, compared him to Mussolini, called him the peanut, and basically was in accord with that assessment and was ultimately replaced as the liaison with Chiang Kai-shek. Continuing with Prouty's account. In this climate, President Roosevelt maneuvered to have Chiang Kai-shek join him in Cairo for a November 22nd to 26th, 1943 meeting with Churchill. Roosevelt wanted to create the atmosphere of a big four by placing Chiang on the world stage. Chiang appeared in Cairo along with his attractive and powerful wife, Madam Chiang Kai-shek, née Mae Ling Sung, daughter of Charlie Jones Sung, and the sister of T.V. Sung, at that time the wealthiest man in the world, and parenthetically, as I would note, Chiang Kai-shek's finance minister. Continuing, Few pictures produced during World War II had been more striking than those of Chang and Roosevelt, apparently, unquote, joking with each other on one side, and an apparently, unquote, convivial Churchill and Madame Chang smiling on the other. With the close of the Cairo conference, the Churchill and Roosevelt delegations flew to Tehran for their own first meeting with Marshal Stalin. This much was released to the public, a fact that was not released, and that even to this day has rarely been made known, is that Chang and the Chinese delegation were also present at the Tehran conference of November 28th through December 1st of 1943. More about the influence of Chiang Kai-shek, Mei Ling Song, and his contingent on the post-World War II events of Asia. Back to Prahi's book. How many of us realize that back in November of 1943, when Winston Churchill and Franklin D. Roosevelt met in Cairo with Chiang Kai-shek, they were not only making plans for victory over the Axis powers in Europe, they were laying the groundwork for a follow-on period of warfare in Eastern Asia, in Indochina of 1945, and Korea of 1950, following the defeat of Japan. Few historians seem to recall that also in Cairo was Chiang Kai-shek's wife, Mei Ling, the American-educated sister of T.V. Sung, then the wealthiest man in the world, and she actually took part in the work of the conference along with the activities of T.V. Sung's Chinese delegates, who were Chang's advisors, Sung by the capital S-O-O-N-G. Continuing. Even more importantly, after these delegates of Chiang Kai-shek and T.V. Sung had actively participated in Cairo in the planning for the post-World War II activities in the Far East, they flew on to Tehran. The fact that immediately following the Cairo conference, the Chinese delegation was in Tehran has not been recorded in the history books of this era. This is a most important omission. I was the pilot of the plane that flew them there from Cairo. During the sometimes heated exchanges, plans were made for a period of continuing warfare in Indochina, Korea, and Indonesia under the guise of that Cold War cover story. And what we're going to take a look at next is some of the networking between the fascist Japanese, who were also occupying Korea at this point in time, and the nationalist Chinese or Kuomintang narco-dictatorship of Chiang Kai-shek. A very important man who went on to become the CIA's top man in Japan for many years, Kodama Yoshio, a very, very important historical figure that we'll probably have to devote a whole program to at some point. But he was in charge of looting the Japanese underworld for Operation Golden Lily, and that enormous wealth looted by the Japanese was folded into and became one of the foundational elements of the post-World War II economy. Part of the point of all of this is that the U.S. signed off not only on the brutalities to which Korea and China as well were subjected to in World War II, they signed on to the looting of these countries. And the looting of Korea took place over hundreds of years, as we looked at in our last program. Now, in this passage, we're going to take a look at Kodama Yoshio's work on behalf of the Black Dragon Society. That is one of the patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies that we have spoken about, the Unification Church, with doctrinal and operational overlap with the fascist Shincheonji cult sued by Park Won-soon in connection with the COVID-19 epidemic, appears to be an extension of those Japanese and patriotic societies. Now, one of the people with whom Kodama Yoshio dealt with was a fellow named Ku Tzu Xuan. He was a key waterfront boss in China, and he got heroine, Fon Kadamayoshia, who was in charge of looting the Chinese underworld on behalf of Golden Lily, and in turn, thanks to his brother, who was a senior general for the Kuomintang, General Ku Chu Tung, Ku Tzu Shuan, his brother, gave U.S. lend-lease materials that were brought at great difficulty and loss of life by Allied transportation personnel through the Burma Road or flying over the hump. And ultimately, a fair amount of that wound up in the hands of the Japanese, courtesy of the Kuomintang. For this information, we're going to look at the book Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, published in softcover by Verso Books. He, Kadama, was sprung from jail by General Doihara in April of 1937 on the condition that he devote his violent energies to looting China's underworld. This epiphany, the transformation of Kadama from thug to super patriot, was suggested by Black Dragon's Toyama Mitsuru, whose own stature as a patriot was affirmed in 1924 when he was a guest at Emperor Hirohito's wedding. All of the proceeds were diverted from Chinese racketeers to Golden Lily, minus, of course, a handling charge for Kadama himself. Ultimately, Kadama was responsible to Prince Chichibu and to the throne itself. Princes were not equipped to deal with gangsters. Kadama saved them from soiling their hands. He converted narcotics into bullion by the simple method of trading heroin to gangsters for gold ingots. How brokers got those ingots was not his concern. Now, note the following here. This is for someone that grew up with Victory at Sea, the old NBC television program. This is just mind-blowing at one level and very sad at another. Kadama closed a deal with waterfront boss Ku Tzu Shuan to swap heroin for gold throughout the Yangtze Valley. Thanks to Ku's brother, Kuomintang Senior General Ku Chu Tung, Japan also gained access to U.S. lend-lease supplies reaching western China by way of the Burma Road or on aircraft flying over the hump from India. Once in warehouses in Kunming or Chongqing, the lend-lease was resold to the Japanese army with Kadama as purchasing agent. And indicative of one of the dynamics that basically unknown by Americans, and that is the there were places in World War II where there were, in effect, wars within wars. One of those that we looked at in connection with Ukraine and the OUNB was the Ukrainian-Polish War, which really was a subsidiary of World War II. Roughly 100,000 Poles were killed by the OUNB during that war within a war. There was also a civil war in China between Mao Zedong's communist forces and the Kuomintang. Among the reasons why ultimately the Mao Zedong forces were ascendant was the fact that they did a much better job of fighting the Japanese. They also didn't sell drugs. Indicative, though, of one of the dynamics of this war within the war, and one of the things that helped to make that nationalist Chinese or Kuomintang so unpopular was the following. Now, bear in mind, General Ku Chu Tung, who basically got the U.S. lend-lease supplies for Japan through his brother Ku Tzu Shuan and Kadama Yoshio. Turning again to Gold Warriors, the Ku brothers had evil reputations. In 1940, General Ku became one of China's most hated men. When the Chinese Communist New Fourth Army passed through his territory on the way to attack the Japanese-held railway between Nanking and Shanghai, Ku ambushed them and massacred all but the headquarters contingent, including many women cadres. All these women were subjected to mass rape and kept in Kuomintang army brothels for the next 18 months, where a number of them committed suicide. As his reward for doing this, General Ku was promoted to commander-in-chief of the Kuomintang armies. I don't think we'll be hearing about that from the hashtag MeToo folks. Now, more about the dealings during World War II between Kagame Yoshio and the Kuomintang regime of Chiang Kai-shek, as we have seen the Green Gang of Shanghai by narcotics boss and organized crime boss Chu Yuesheng was the basic muscle for General Tai Li. Tai Li had the nickname of the Himmler of China. He was Chiang Kai-shek's brutal security chief, and he too was dealing directly with Kagame Yoshio and channeling key strategic goods to the Kagame Agency. The Kagame Agency was in charge of helping to develop resources for the Imperial Japanese Naval Air Arm. It was founded on December 8th of 1941, which in Japan was the day that Pearl Harbor was attacked. They're on the other side of the international dateline. Of the networking between General Tai Li and Kagame Yoshio. And by the way, you'll hear a reference here to the Strike South. This was the entry point of the U.S. into World War II. The attack on Pearl Harbor was intended to neutralize the U.S. 7th Fleet so that it could not interfere with the main part of the Japanese attack, which was the so-called Strike South. The major goal was to gain control of the Indonesian oil fields and rubber plantations of Indonesia and the Philippines. This after the U.S. cut off the oil to Japan. Most of the Japanese war effort up to that point was fueled by oil shipments from the U.S. After the U.S. cut off oil, that mandated the Strike South. And in order for the Strike South to be secured against U.S. naval interference, the attack on Pearl Harbor took place. Of the transactions between Kagame Yoshio and General Tai Li, Chiang Kai-shek's security chief, we read, officially, Kagame was in Shanghai as a buyer for the Imperial Navy Air Force under the rubric of the Kagame Kikan, or Kagame, Agency. Special service units were named after the officer in charge and then called an agency. On paper, his mission was to locate and acquire supplies of copper, cobalt, nickel, and mica. In most cases, he bought these directly from Kuomintang Secret Police Chief General Tai Li, who was paid in heroin. According to U.S. intelligence, the Kagame Agency took over the salt monopoly, molybdenum mines, farms, fisheries, and munitions plants. Just before Pearl Harbor and the Strike South, Kagame accompanied Prince Takeda to Japan's southern military headquarters in Saigon to confer with Field Marshal Terauchi, son of the general who had looted and brutalized Korea. Because the Strike South would involve Japan's Navy, and the Navy would administer the Malay Archipelago through which treasure ships for Golden Lily must pass, Kagame was transferred overnight from the Army to the Navy and given the rank of Rear Admiral. This was like making Al Capone a U.S. Navy Admiral. Kagame returned to Shanghai just in time for Pearl Harbor. Bearing in mind, we're going to turn back now to the book JFK, The CIA, Vietnam, and the Plot to Assassinate John F. Kennedy by L. Fletcher Prouty, recalling the important role that Chiang Kai-shek and his wife, the former Mei Ling Sung, played in the Cairo and Tehran conferences and the bearing that ultimately had after Franklin D. Roosevelt's death on the post-World War II developments in Asia. The following is a very interesting, telling, and significant event. Prouty writes, one of the best kept and least discussed secrets of early Cold War planning took place sometime before the surrender of Japan. It had a great impact on the selection of Korea and Indochina as the locations of the early Cold War hostilities between the communists and the anti-communists. Despite the terrific damage done to mainland Japan by aerial bombardment, even before the use of atomic bombs, the invasion of Japan had been considered to be an essential prelude to victory and to, quote, unconditional, unquote, surrender. Planning for this invasion had been underway for years. As soon as the island of Okinawa became available as the launching site for this operation, supplies and equipment for an invasion force of at least 500,000 men began to be stacked up 15 to 20 feet high all over Okinawa. Then, with the early surrender of Japan, this massive invasion did not occur, and the use of this enormous stockpile of military equipment was not necessary. Almost immediately, U.S. Navy transport vessels began to show up in Naha Harbor, Okinawa. This vast load of war material was reloaded onto those ships. I was in Okinawa at that time, and during some business in the harbor area, I asked the harbor master if all that new material was being returned to the U.S. His response was direct and surprising. Hell no. The States ain't never gonna see it again. One half of this stuff, enough to equip and supply at least 150,000 men, is going to Korea. And the other half is going to Indochina. In 1945, none of us had any idea that the first battles of the Cold War were going to be fought by U.S. military units in those two regions, beginning in 1950 and 1965. Yet that is precisely what had been planned, and it is precisely what happened. Who made that decision back in 1943 and through 45? We'll get a hint of that later in the program. Now, next, we're going to turn to the book The Judas Factor, The Plot to Kill Malcolm X by Carl Evans, Thunder's Mouth Press, copyright 1992. In this book, there is some discussion of what we now call the Third World and the evolution of nations that became known as the non-aligned nations. And part of this was the history of the division of Korea. Now, in Korea, the U.S. set up a dictator in the south under a dictatorship under Syngman Rhee, R-A-G-E. The Soviets set up the North Korea under Kim Il-sung, the grandfather of Kim Jong-un, I think it's Kim Jong-un, the current president or head of South Korea. What is not known is that there was a major figure named Kim Koo, K-I-M, last name K-O-O. He was revered in Korea. He had lived in Shanghai during World War II, and he was an advocate of the reunification of the two Koreas. That, again, the reconciliation between the North and South was a major focal point of the work of the late Park Won-soon, the recently deceased, and I believe under very strange circumstances, of the mayor of Seoul. Kim Koo, again, who was advocating a reunification of North and South Korea, was assassinated in 1949, in all probability by the CIA. This is discussed by Carl Evans in The Judas Factor as follows. After World War II ended and Japan was ejected from Korea, U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt and Joseph Stalin of the Soviet Union reached an agreement at the Yalta Conference in February of 1945, under which Korea would be governed by a joint trusteeship. The U.S. would govern the southern half of the nation, while North Korea would be under the Soviet Union's control. Enter Kim Koo. Again, first name K-I-M, last name K-O-O. Kim, who had lived in Shanghai during the war, returned to Korea after the Japanese occupation ended. He opposed the joint trusteeship, fearing that it would lead to a permanent division of his homeland. Kim became a folk hero to Koreans, but a fly in the ointment to the U.S. Kim's fears became reality when General John R. Hodge, H-O-B-G-E, commander of the U.S. occupation forces, held a rigged election in which Kim and U.S. protege Syngman Rhee became leaders of South Korea. In the interim, the Soviet Union installed Kim Il-sung in newly independent North Korea, re-opposed the power-sharing plan in the South, particularly since Kim Koo was pressing forward with plans to reunite Korea. In June of 1949, General Kim Chang-yong, Ri's close advisor and chief of Korea's Counterintelligence Corps, or CIC, founded by and patterned after the CIA, conspired with American intelligence officers and a young lieutenant to assassinate Kim Koo. On June 26th, 1949, while 73-year-old Kim was resting in his second-floor bedroom, Lieutenant An Do-hee, that's capital A-H-N, capital D-O, capital H-I, walked past three policemen standing guard outside, entered the house, proceeded to Kim's bedroom, and shot him to death. Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai, who had harbored Kim for more than 20 years, were certain that the assassination had been ordered by Ri's American advisor, who also served as Ri's anti-espionage chief. Although there was evidence that the American was a CIA officer, no one was able to prove it, and An wasn't talking. Shortly after the assassination, An's family was spirited out of Korea and brought to America. The An family's departure only served to heighten speculation that Kim's assassination was engineered by the CIA. An tried to join his family in America, but was prevented by forces loyal to Kim. Today, June 26th, is a national day of mourning in Korea. Now, of more than passing interest is the presence of both John Foster Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell, and the aforementioned Kodama Yoshio in Korea on the eve of the outbreak of the Korean War. Exactly what they were doing there is a matter of speculation. We will never know. But returning once again to the book Gold Warriors by the Seagraves, in October of 1949, the People's Republic of China came into being. 8 months later, in June of 1950, the Korean War broke out. Just before the war began, Kodama Yoshio accompanied John Foster Dulles to negotiations in Seoul. The Dulles party also included Kodama's protege Machi Hisayuki, boss of the Korean Yakuza in Japan. Efforts to discover under freedom of information what Kodama and Machii did during the trip with Dulles have run into a stone wall. In the MacArthur Memorial Archive, we discovered a personal letter from Kodama to General MacArthur offering to provide thousands of Yakuza and former Japanese Army soldiers to fight alongside American soldiers in Korea. According to sources in Korea and Japan, the offer was accepted, and these men joined the Allied force on the peninsula, posing as Korean soldiers. Again, we don't know exactly what Kodama was doing there with John Foster Dulles on the eve of the outbreak of the Korean War. I wonder if perhaps they were looking to lure the North Koreans into attacking, although it was assumed at the time that the invasion of South Korea by the North was part of a grand worldwide communist plan of conquest. Turns out not even Stalin himself had advocated that. There's good discussion of that in the book, but is in some ways excellent, in some ways unremarkable, and that is the book The Brothers by Stephen Kinzer. I wonder if perhaps the North Koreans were lured in a way perhaps not unlike what happened in the first Gulf War, when the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, a woman named April Glaspie, basically indicated to Saddam Hussein that it would be okay with the U.S. if Iraq invaded Kuwait. Then when Iraq did invade Kuwait, the U.S. crushed Saddam Hussein. Again, I don't know. I wonder if something like that may have happened. But certainly, Kodama Yoshio did provide combatants, both former Japanese Army soldiers and Korean and Japanese Yakuza gangsters, to fight on behalf of South Korea, posing as Japanese soldiers. Now, the presence of Kodama Yoshio and John Foster Dulles in Korea. Bear in mind that at that point in time, John Foster Dulles had just been appointed a U.S. Senator in New York. He was to become Secretary of State in 1953. And along with his brother Alan, they were key partners in the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm that helped to conclude many of the cartel deals that helped to arm the Axis. Bearing in mind the presence of both John Foster Dulles and Kodama Yoshio in Seoul on the eve of the outbreak of the Korean War, the following is more than a little interesting, turning once again to JFK, the CIA, Vietnam, and the plot to assassinate John F. Kennedy by L. Fletcher Proudy. It was this same John Foster Dulles in Korea, serving as no more than a bipartisan consultant, unquote, to the Department of State in June of 1950, who had said, quote, "No matter what you say about the President of Korea, Syngman Rhee, and the President of Nationalist China, Chiang Kai-shek, these two gentlemen are the equivalent of the founder of the church. They are Christian gentlemen." Then, while still in Korea on June 19th of 1950, John Foster Dulles made a most unusual speech before the Korean Parliament. Quote, "The American people welcome you as an equal partner in the great company of those who make up the free world. I say to you, you are not alone. You will never be alone as long as you continue to play worthily your part in the great design of human freedom." Unquote. The Koreans, taken completely by surprise, wondered what he meant by those words. Less than 1 week later, however, when the North Koreans invaded South Korea, they found out. On the very next Sunday, while Dulles was still in Japan, the Korean War broke out with an attack on the South by the North Koreans. For someone of his stature, a senior partner of the largest law firm in New York City, Sullivan and Cromwell, and a man who had found a worldwide platform in the World Council of Churches, these had been most unusual statements on many counts. They were surpassed only by his prediction, unquote, of the outbreak of the Korean War at that time. As for his other statement about Christian gentlemen, unquote, few there are who have held the same opinion of President Rhee and Generalissimo Chiang, particularly the latter. And bearing in mind, again, some of the role of the Korean War and the treaty, the peace treaty of 1951 that John Foster Dulles negotiated, which basically absolved Japan of any reparations payments, saying that Japan was bankrupt when in fact they were rolling in dough. I mean, they had so much money. What is to be noted here is that there was apparently some very selective bombing of Japan during World War II. The civilian infrastructure in Japan was devastated, but infrastructure as a whole was largely intact. Turning once again to Gold Warriors by the Seagraves. Despite propaganda to the contrary, American and Europeans who toured Japan immediately after the war were surprised that infrastructure, factories, utilities, and railways were largely intact thanks to selective American bombing. Firebombing had destroyed tens of thousands of the tinderbox homes of ordinary Japanese, giving Tokyo the look of a devastated city. But great estates, factories, and vital infrastructure seemed magically to have been spared. John Dower notes, quote, "Vast areas of poor people's residences, small shops, and factories in the capital were gutted, but a good number of the homes of the wealthy and fashionable neighborhoods survived. Tokyo's financial district was largely undamaged. Undamaged also was the building that housed much of the imperial military bureaucracy at war's end. Railways still functioned more or less effectively throughout the country. U.S. bombing had tended to reaffirm existing hierarchies of fortune." and things were basically devastated throughout much of Japan, but the elite actually did very, very well for themselves. It is noted by the Seagraves that the average Japanese at this point in time had to work two jobs in order to earn a single potato to keep them alive, but that the Emperor of Japan, after reading directly from the book, during the occupation, many ordinary Japanese worked two jobs to earn enough to buy one potato each day. During the same period, Emperor Hirohito was earning $50 million a year in interest merely on his Swiss bank accounts alone. So again, there appears to have been some highly selective bombing of Japan during World War II. The civilians were just devastated, but not so the infrastructure and the properties of the wealthy. This suggests that even in the military prosecution of the bombing, some of the cartel dynamics that we're going to get into here in just a minute obtained rather effectively. Now, in 1951, John Foster Dulles, in the middle of the Korean War and the supposed world onslaught, so it was seen at that time by the communists, successfully negotiated the 1951 peace treaty, which despite the fact that Japan had under its belt the looted wealth of all of Asia, which then was folded into the post-World War II global financial structure, Japan was declared to be bankrupt and absolved of all payments to either nations or to the POWs and civilians who had been enslaved by the Japanese. The Seagraves write about this in Gold Warriors. Washington insisted, beginning in 1945, that Japan never stole anything and was flat broke and bankrupt when the war ended. Here was the beginning of many great distortions which would become terrible secrets. Because the treasure amassed by Golden Lily and covered by Washington had to be kept secret, citizens of Japan and America were grossly deceived. The 1951 peace treaty with Japan was skewed by these deceits, so thousands of POWs and civilians who were forced to perform slave labor for Japanese corporations received no compensation for their suffering. To shield Japan from demands for war reparations, John Foster Dulles met privately with three Japanese to work out the treaty terms in secret. One of the three, Miyazawa Kichi, later served as Japan's prime minister and repeatedly as its minister of finance. According to Article 14 of the treaty, quote, "It is recognized that Japan should pay reparations to the Allied powers for the damage and suffering caused by it during the war. Nevertheless, it is also recognized that the resources of Japan are not presently sufficient." To reinforce the claim that Japan was broke, Article 14 stated, quote, "The Allied powers waive all reparations claims of the Allied powers and their nationals arising out of any actions taken by Japan." One more time. "The Allied powers," quote, "The Allied powers waive all reparations claims of the Allied powers and their nationals arising out of any actions taken by Japan," unquote. By signing the treaty, Allied countries concurred that Japan's plunder had vanished down a rabbit hole and all of Japan's victims were out of luck. In return for going along with the treaty, we have documented that Washington sent secret shipments of black gold recovered by Semperomama to beef up the Allies' exhausted central banks. As we now know, Japan was not bankrupted by the war. By 1951, 6 years after the war, Japan's economy was stronger than it had been during the best business years before the war. Carlos Romulo, R-O-M-U-L-O, head of the Philippine delegation to the peace conference, quote, "demolished the U.S. argument that Japan lacked the ability to pay for economic reasons," unquote. Japan's industrial activity was 32% above pre-war levels, its fiscal position showed a surplus, and its balance of trade had moved into the black. In discussions between U.S. monetary experts and Japan's finance minister, Hideki Hayato, just before the peace conference, Hayato admitted to a budget surplus of over 100 billion yen and planned to use 40 billion of it as a tax rebate to Japanese citizens. The governor of the Bank of Japan pleaded with U.S. authorities to take custody of $200 million worth of gold holdings because he feared, quote, the Filipinos might try to attach the gold as reparations. Again, I think the selective bombing of Japan, obviously, as well as the folding of the orgiastic wealth looted by Operation Golden Lily, including and especially from Korea and Japan, Korea and China. I think the cartels, the giant associations of transnational corporations, figure front and center in this dynamic. And John Foster Dulles was one of the prime movers of the cartels. Turning now to the brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War by Stephen Kinzer. Foster had helped design the Dulles Plan of 1924, which restructured Germany's reparations payments in ways that opened up huge new markets for American banks. And later that year, he arranged for five of them to lend $100 million to German borrowers. In the 7 years that followed, he and his partners brokered another $900 million in loans to Germany, the equivalent of more than $15 billion in early 21st century dollars. This made Foster Dulles the preeminent salesman of German bonds in the U.S., probably the world. He sharply rejected critics who argued that American banks should invest more inside of the U.S. and protested when the State Department sought to restrict loans to Germany that were unrelated to reparations payments or that supported cartels or monopolies. Foster made much money building and advising cartels, which are based on agreements among competing firms to control supplies, fix prices, and close their supply and distribution networks to outsiders. Reformers in many countries railed against these cartels, but Foster defended them as guarantors of stability that ensured profits while protecting economies from unpredictable swings. To the V-shape became global forces. Among Foster's premier clients was the New Jersey-based International Nickel Company, for which he was not only counsel but also a director and member of the executive board. In the early 1930s, he steered it along with its Canadian affiliate into a cartel with France's two major nickel producers. In 1934, he brought the biggest German nickel producer, IG Farben, into the cartel. This gave Nazi Germany access to the cartel's resources. Without Dulles, according to a study of Sullivan and Cromwell, Germany would have lacked any negotiating strength with International Nickel, which controlled the world's supply of nickel, which is a crucial ingredient in stainless steel and armor plate. IG Farben was also one of the world's largest chemical companies. It would produce the Zyklon B gas used at Nazi death camps, and as Foster was bringing it into the nickel cartel, he also helped it establish a global chemical cartel. He was a board member and legal counsel for another chemical producer, the Solvay conglomerate based in Belgium. During the 1930s, he guided Solvay, IG Farben, the American firm Allied Chemical and Dye, and several other companies into a chemical cartel just as potent as the one he had organized for nickel producers. In mid-1931, the consortium of American banks, eager to safeguard their investments in Germany, persuaded the German government to accept a loan of nearly $500 million to prevent default. Foster was their agent. His ties to the German government tightened after Hitler took power at the beginning of 1933 and appointed Foster's old friend Hjalmar Schacht as Minister of Economics. Both men had considered entering the clergy before turning their powerful minds toward more remunerative pursuits. Each admired the culture that had produced the other. Both Schacht and Foster Dulles believed that a resurgent Germany would stand against Bolshevism. Mobilizing American capital to finance its rise was their common interest. Skipping down. During the 1930s, through a series of currency maneuvers, discounted buybacks, and other forms of financial warfare, Germany effectively defaulted on its debts to American investors. Foster represented the investors in unsuccessful appeals to Germany, many of them addressed to his old friend, Schacht. Clients who had followed Sullivan and Cromwell's advice to buy German bonds lost fortunes. That advice, according to one study, cost Americans $1 billion because Schacht seduced Dulles into supporting Germany for far too long. Foster had clear financial reasons to collaborate with the Nazi regime, and his ideological reason, Hitler was fiercely anti-Bolshevik, was equally compelling. In later years, scholars would ask about his actions in the world. Did he do it out of a desire to protect economic privilege, or out of anti-communist fervor? The best answer may be that to him, there was no difference. In his mind, defending the multinational business... defending multinational business and fighting Bolshevism were the same thing. Since 1933, all letters written from the German offices of Sullivan and Cromwell had ended, as required by German regulations, with the salutation, Heil Hitler. That did not disturb Foster. He turned out magazine and newspaper articles, asserting that the, quote, dynamic countries of the world, Germany, Italy, and Japan, quote, feel within themselves potentialities which are suppressed, unquote, and that Hitler's semi-secret rearmament project simply showed that, quote, Germany, by unilateral action, has now taken back her freedom of action. And we're going to conclude by noting from the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning that is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website that the Korean War was the a driving engine for the economic revitalization of both West Germany and Japan because they manufactured goods for the Pentagon. In particular, the Thyssenfirn manufactured armor plate using some of the nickel cartel that Foster had set up. Of the role of the Korean War in helping to drive the economic revitalization of Germany and Japan, Manning writes, a substantial infusion of money into this new Federal Republic economy resulted from the Korean War in 1950. The U.S. was not geared to supplying all its needs for armies in Korea, so the Pentagon placed huge orders in West Germany and in Japan. From that point on, both nations waned into an era of booming good times. And it is those deep politics that loom large in the background and foreground of the death of Park Won-soon. This concludes For the Record program number 1142, Deep Politics and the Death of Park Won-soon, Part 3, being recorded on July 24th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.